Hello, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast which has served this country for seven generations, but that seems not to count for much these days. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm that order of pizza marinari you called for, which is so many great plot lines started so similarly, didn't they? But that's not for here. Although, is it? I think we've actually reached Carry On Doctor, haven't we?
We have, indeed. And so we're carrying on up the Khyber right up to Scotland via Sussex for Terror of the Zygons.
Oh, hang on, what's that? Isn't that Douglas Camfield singing that little dirgy ditty right now? Because you know it's Dougie Camfield singing when Ockwee Angus is polishing up his eyeballs.
Really?
Polishing up Broton's remote eyeballs. Yeah, on the 11th stagger. Do you think there's a listener alive or indeed past who hasn't seen this story? Because I know our chums in Canada haven't seen it yet, have they?
Have they not? No.
Yeah.
It was the last DVD to be released, wasn't it? The DVD...
Until a Philip Morris extravaganza, which were two.
But it was certainly very late, and people were asking, why is this coming so late?
It was always intended to be the last of the classic BBC range, and then the Philip Morris rediscoveries, of which we're still promised, 16 or 17.
Well, now even Tom Spilsbury has said that he firmly believes there is nothing left to come back.
So, right.
Oh, that's for another podcast.
Then. Yes. Okay. Anyway, we talked about all this back in around episode 15 to 20. We're not still bitter that we don't have enough Patrick in our lives, are we? No. Don't be silly. Moving on. Richard, Terror of the Zygons is yours.
Well, it's funny you should mention Patrick. Isn't this actually an Avengers story that just happens to have the Doctor in it again? Oh, hang on, it's Robert Banks Stewart. And he'll come and do this again to us at the end of the year when it's...
Yes.
Do you know what the original plot of this was?
What?
It was a gaggle. Q. Gareth Roberts, if we're thinking of The Well-Mannered War or The English Way of Death, or indeed, what are the... Closing Time? What are some of the news stories that Gareth has written for
Shakespeare
the series?
Code.
That was fun, yeah.
The Lodger.
The Lodger.
I love The Lodger.
Yeah.
The Lodger. The trickster stories with Sarah Jane.
They were... Great.
Whatever happened with Sarah Jane.
Adventures.
Yeah.
We know she's hanging around in Surrey putting on a faux Maggie Smith accent. This one, the original plot, was a story of a gaggle of eccentrics faking a monster attack in an attempt for world domination, inverted commas. If that's not a Diana Rigg story, I don't know what is.
It sounds like a robot.
Well, apparently Robert Banks Stewart did seem to be a bit miffed that he'd kind of been excised from the Avengers when Terry Nation, in fact, took over script editing in the Tara King Linda Thorson season. And Banks Stewart was kind of given a bit of an elbow. So maybe there are a few old plots hanging around. But in the early days, yes, that was the vision of this. But it soon turned into something a hell of a lot more exciting. You know, it wasn't even called the Zygote Zygons thing. Let's just look at what the Zygons are. Because I think this story is totally fantastic for three things. It's the way the central cast just work together so brilliantly and stretch themselves out in new ways. Harry is kind of amazing in this, really. Probably the best he'll ever be, simply by being anti-Harry. You know, what a shame he didn't end up going to Zeta Minor and doing a rumba with the with the shower curtain monster. That would have been great. The
it
anti-Harry.
Could have only improved it.
He will get to come back and be evil again.
Yes, when Doctor Who reboots,
worse way.
Doctor Who reboots the zombie apocalypse by having a much loved pre-seasonal, you know, previous season companion who was everything we ever wanted to be, act as if he's a walking cadaver.
Yeah, terrible.
But back to where we are, timey-wise. Yes, the second one is the location and the secondary cast. I don't want to call them the extras because they shine as brilliantly and brightly. Oh, Duke of Forgle, you've won my heart. Never leave me.
John Woodnett is just amazing.
Well, wouldn't you? Yeah. Isn't he brilliant? Yeah. There's always the saturnine Surly. You realise it's Broton picking them up in his red Range Rover. Number three is design and especially costume design and really glam rock fetuses The same sort of pink things we used to put our bath soaps on in the 70s that had little suction cups all over the mats.
That's
little Zygon fetal things, Zygon foot pads. That's what they are. Now, it looks beautiful. It's James Acheson again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and absolutely. Set design is Nigel Curzon, whom we love and admire.
Yeah.
So it's through the deleted scene, yes. It's frocking up. You know what this was meant to be, don't you? This was Dougie's own insertion, Canfield's own insertion, as the tail end to his very first unit story, Invasion, where the TARDIS appears invisible in a cow field.
Yes, that's very true.
And it was Canfield's homage to that. So, did you get it? Did you get it?
It was in the novelisation, so I was always aware of the scene, but it was never in the show. My favourite thing about it, there's two great things about it, I think. And one is that Tom knows he's in Scotland because he's dressed for it. That's what he says.
Yes.
I'm dressed for it. And there's a little moment where Sarah and Harry are there and they're just speculating about where they could be. They could be anywhere in the world. They could be in a forest in sort of Eastern Europe or something.
Or Sussex.
Yeah, Sussex more like it. But that's kind of nice. I think it is a good scene. And I think it looks all right on the DVD, doesn't
it? Yeah.
They had to fix it.
The colorization is so good. I believe it was colorized by Stuart Humphreys of Babel Color, who also worked on the Mind of Evil episode 1 colorization, for which we adore him. But it's one of those things where you can see why it was cut out. It doesn't move the plot anywhere at all. It's just this charming character moment between these three people. And I think had Terror of the Zygons not been held back, because it was meant to go out immediately after Revenge of the Cybermen, I think they might have kept it if it had been the following week, because as you were saying through most of last season, Nathan, our three heroes go through some really horrible stuff in that arc of stories from Ark in Space through to Revenge of the Cybermen. So to have them land and have this little scene where they're going, oh, where are we? I'm dressed for Scotland, so we're in Scotland. It's a fun little moment, but it only adds putting it back in. Yeah. We aren't bereft, because the rest of the story is so amazing anyway.
Although as a young viewer, I really loved that they just came traipsing and trolling out of the woods, cough, cough, together, wearing each other's clothes. It set up a great...
It's
also that there might indeed have been a whole other adventure we promulgated, and probably used that word because we were those sorts of children, in the playground the next day. Remember that? I was saying, well, what had they been? Perhaps there'd been a whole other adventure. Do you realise, before we move into the story, because this is just one of the things that's just too exciting to not take the scenic route around the banks of the loch, do you realise that Sir Peter Scott was a conservationist, and he was scanning the loch, as he did, so he's something of an eccentric, released a sonar shot of what looked like a fin, or more technically correct, a fluke of a large sea creature in Loch Ness. And he immediately had it, and Nathan, you can correct us on our Latin, immediately had it declared Nessetarius rhombopteryx, which is, as far as I know, means something called Nessie that's got a rhomboid fin.
But
what about the thorax?
we never got to that bit. But it was so it could be declared an endangered species.
Oh.
And it was a wee little thing. It wasn't the size of, because I don't honestly think that the Scarison would be able to flaunt it about in Loch Ness. It's a bit too big.
It's a bit too stop motion.
But yeah, all these really lovely, interesting things were going on, and then of course this is the perfect setting, and as of course you haven't mentioned Sandifer yet, we haven't had a drink. This is the winter season, and as a boy we had a very cold winter in Sydney that year, and I remember running home from school through fields not unlike, yes, we had fields even in freshwater, and thinking about the coldness of this season and this particular story, and it really bit in and it won it on that under level. And Sandra has talked about autumnal themes being about the internal dialogue and being about the world inside, which is why you don't get a lot of great horror stories set on beaches. It tends to be about woodsy, colder places where the mind turns in on itself. This story also does a lovely thing of the silky folk, which do sound like something Nathan would have just bought as a pet. But these were the seals in Scottish legend, the seals who would occasionally assume human form, very much like the English fairy stories. And the fairy folk were not the little things dancing in the bottom of your garden. They swapped human children for their own folk who were changelings so that they could move about in the real world as well. It's a perfect Zygon story. It's quite beautiful. Oh, Sarah can't read medieval Latin in this one. Did you notice that in the library?
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed, actually.
But she can in the Ghosts of Innspace. Did you all go away and listen to that?
Well, she obviously boned up on it. That can't be right. That's said beforehand.
Why would anybody listen to the Ghosts of Innspace? It's almost like someone on this podcast recommended it.
There are a lot of Scottish things here. There are. You know what I mean? So we recreate...
I'm wearing tartan as we speak. So is
we recreate the opening... the opening moment of the Sea Devils, don't we? Only with a oil rig
and infinitely superior music from the wonderful pen and conductor's baton of Jeffrey Bergen.
Thanks for citing Jeffrey Bergen, because that's the reason this story ultimately works.
It's really
the
good.
Costumes are beautiful, but the music is everything. And look at Seeds of Doom again. Mm. Canfield and Bergen are a winning combo, aren't they?
And we have to thank for this the old 1960s misunderstanding between Dougie Canfield and Dudley Simpson, meaning Canfield never wanted to work with Simpson again and thus didn't.
I didn't realise there was a reason. I thought he just wanted to put his own texture in.
No. Apparently there was a dinner party after Planet of Giants, because that was the thing that the two of them worked on.
I believe they did also work on The Crusade as well.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah.
But they had a dinner party, and I think Canfield asked Simpson how much money he made.
I think it was a bit more presumptuous on Canfield's part. Apparently, yes, he did ask Dudley how much do you make, and Dudley said, "Oh, I make this much." But then he asked Dudley, "Where do you live?" And Canfield thought, "Well, that's a very expensive area of London." Mm. He's either lied to me about his wage, or he's come across the money in some other way, and I don't deal with people who are dishonest. And it turned out to be something like Dudley or his wife had inherited the house or inherited some money to buy the house. So, you know, there was nothing untoward going on at all, but for some reason that really got Dougie's back up, possibly because, you know, he was a very straight down the line ex-military man.
Yeah, but I think also part of Canfield's brilliance and his curmudgeonliness is his very short temper.
Yeah.
So that's why he was able to cut through the dross very quickly and get things done. It also meant his decision was the only one where there was any truth, which also made it perhaps not the easiest of guests to deal with. But he and Tom got on very well.
Yeah,
I mean, quite similar
Tom is
characters,
very much like
actually.
That, isn't
yeah,
it?
But yeah. That later on, that might not have been the way when there was no Philip Hinchcliffe to keep Tom in his box.
Yes.
As we'll get to later on. I really can't go past the Duke of Forgal and Broton. And I honestly believe, Nathan, you were saying earlier, that there is no Duke of Forgal. It's just Broton mincing about all the time, having a lovely time.
Right from the very beginning. Yeah, it's very clear that it's... because remember Angus McRanald? I'm not going to do that again. who is the terribly camp landlord of the Fox Inn, isn't it?
Yeah. Hello, Fox,
the Fox Inn! I love that so much. Harry's been shot.
They really should. They should have really had their own little spin-off series, shouldn't they? With Broton and Angus running and the Cabo in the Fox Inn, running their own painting and decorating business from polishing up the eyeballs.
Despite the fact he doesn't have a boyfriend in this one, like he did in the Ice Warriors, he's still as camp as ever, and he's wonderful.
He's
camp as Scarison lactic outlets. Yeah.
Oh, more of that later. Yeah, because he's already delivered the stag's head, the bugged stag's head, to the Fox Inn.
Yes, yes.
So he has been Broton for a long time, but he is just hilarious. And, you know, like, why does he pick them up in the car? You know, I think he comes over to pick a fight with Mr. Huckleham to deliver some valuable exposition, I think. but otherwise... You know, he's just gone.
In the shape of a haggis. Wrapped up in string.
Yeah. And we have a haggis mentioned.
We even do in the first episode.
So the first thing, the guy talks about haggis. He says, "Disney can" instead of "doesn't know." You know, we've got Angus Rennie playing the bagpipes upstairs. You've got the Brigadier in a kilt. You know, it is a kind of ludicrous theme park version of Scotland.
And well, we've done it to the Welsh, haven't we?
We have. With the Welsh, it was a bit more insulting because...
Nobody respects them anyway.
Well, no.
It's kind of what was coming across.
If you start going on about redheads again, I'm leaving. I think because there were real political concerns and political issues that were addressed in
there certainly were in Scotland at the time as well. The North Sea gas and oil, where they were talking about separation just as they have done this year. And it was, and part of that in the Scottish Parliament was how the dramas and how the stuff we get on Scottish TV for our children completely dissembles and makes fun of the of Scotland, and then this goes out.
Yeah.
But I do think it's only very vaguely political in a way that Green Death wasn't. Green Death was very definitely political. The kind of theme parkness of the Scotland isn't quite.
There's not a lot of politics in history, although there is world ecology, just as there was in Green Death. Same thing.
Yeah, and we even get the Doctor giving us the environmental moral of the story in the first episode, where he chastises the Brigadier for calling him back to deal with an emergency. Oil? An emergency? You need to stop powering your planet with a mineral slime. There's your emergency. You
start looking at hydrogen, did he mention in this one?
No, he will mention next story. He'll mention an alternative. Yeah. Oh, actually, he does mention hydrogen.
I think he mentions hydrogen, because that's been in the news this year as well, as something that may well be.
And just this morning, I watched the last in the current run of the new Thunderbirds Ago, which featured the Supreme Hadron Collider.
Wow, it's gone from large to remember. Supreme.
Isn't that just Diana Ross's new reboot?
Diana Ross is a nuclear physicist. Danger in Cincinnati.
It'll be a chain reaction if you don't watch it.
Oh. Usually we only get this far off topic if there's nothing to talk about in the story, but I think this story just has so much.
It's so big, this is the thing.
Well, let's go back. Like,
let's do your checklist. I love your checklist.
I don't have a checklist this time.
It's not Terry Nation.
There may be one coming up. But let's look, because we do get hints of the aliens already. So we get the normal end of episode one alien reveal, where we actually see...
Yeah, and for once, it's incredibly effective. I think it's more effective than when the Daleks turn up, because we don't know what a Zygon looks like. We've had a few hints and grabs in there. And also, it's attacking Sarah, so there's a cliffhanger moment. It zooms in on its face. The face is, for human expectations, the face is underdeveloped and malformed. It's an incredibly effective cliffhanger using the old Doctor Who trope of let's reveal the monster at the end of episode one.
It is really effective, and of course it's beautifully shot by Dougie Campfield. But in the lead up to that, we actually see that the inn is being bugged, and so you get a sort of stag head eye view of what's going on in the Fox Inn. And you get the hands manipulating the controls. And I have a Doctor Who club at school, and we watched this a little while ago, and the kids just roared with laughter at these rubbery hands manipulating the controls. It really is just incredibly rude looking.
How did they respond when Tom got to it? Because there's nothing of it. That's real love right there.
Yeah. And you know what? It looks like, when he's performing that scene, that Tom actually hasn't seen the console before, because the smile he gets through his face, I don't think that's the Doctor, I think that's Tom suddenly going, hold on, this looks like, okay, keep it together, oh, I'm having so much fun.
Which I'm never ordering pizza marinara.
And of course, that end of episode one cliffhanger takes place in the hospital, because Harry has been shot because
by Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with a Scottish accent. Same difference. Yeah. It's the same part, isn't it? It's the same actress.
And we don't quite know why he turns
it's
up.
It's pretty brutal,
does.
Though.
Well, in fact, there's some really beautiful direction there, because the first guy who was complaining about the haggis on the oil rig stumbles up the beach. And it's just absolutely beautifully shot.
Because it's directly lifted from the Avengers story, The Town of No Return.
The Town of No Return. I was just going to say that, yeah.
Does Campfield ever direct for the Avengers?
Yes.
No, he does.
No, are you sure he does? I thought he did on Maneater of Surrey Green. That's not Dougie. Yes, that does look a gorgeous thing when they come up from the beach. But that's also been in other films, lots of World War II films, where there was an obsession about spies coming in from the watery depths, if not the cold.
It's just beautifully lit, like spectacularly lit. That guy gets shot dead, and then Harry gets shot, and he gets captured by the fabulously scary Sister Lambert.
Nurse Ratched, yes.
Yes.
And then he gets
I think she's scarier than Nurse Ratched.
I think she's the scariest thing to have ever been in Doctor Who at any time before or since.
She's really great in episode, I think it's episode three.
That bedpan would be full of ice cubes. You just know it. Nurse, the sheets! I'm not changing your sheets again, Dr. Sullivan. You've been a very naughty boy, haven't you?
Oh, you do that so well.
I don't think that would have been his response.
So, Harry gets taken down to the spaceship and given just the most incredible guided tour by Broke.
Yes, yes. Infotopic. We don't often get visitors in here. We don't often get strangers in here.
Yeah, no, so everything shows him how to change people into other people, shows him the Scarisan, explains about the lactic fluid. So
do you like what we've done with the wallpaper?
I think the lactic fluid is worth mentioning. So
I think it's a bit too much. What did they live on before they got to? Because you know it was a little embryo. It's an embryo. What were they living on?
Well, I think they probably had 600 is it like Yakult? Of lactic fluid in the fridge.
Or powdered lactic fluid. Powdered Scarisan lactic fluid.
But he does mention that I'd like to think it's bonded polycarbide armour, but we don't actually know other than that's not the Garrison's native form. It's been armoured as a weapon.
Yes.
So I'd like to think it's just a lovely, big, never-ending story, dragon puppy type affair.
So I'm going to put something in the show notes, which is from the TARDIS index file from BBC America. And if you look up the Zygons, it actually shows a picture of the Scarisan sort of coming along a conveyor belt and being milked into milk bottles.
No!
kind of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy style.
Stop motion, though.
No, it's like that animation from Hitchhikers, because it's like it's really great. So I will put that in the show notes.
I will also say that in the later Big Finish story, The Zygon Who Fell to Earth, there is another Scarisan. And Tim Brooke Taylor plays a Zygon called Mims, and it's his job to milk the Scarisan.
Brilliant. Oh. Now, is there any truth in the
mink room? Gloves, you've got to be terribly careful.
Is there any truth in the rumour, Brendan, that you used Scarisan lactic fluid in the creation of this month's baked good?
I did indeed. Dear listener, you will find on the website the recipe for Zygon carrot and apple muffins.
It really did look like you were heaving into a Zygon breastplate. Extraordinary thing, and quite beautiful, and yes, I can recommend them. Riley, okay. The thing is, I'm trying to work out what the Zygon stinger, you know, these costumes were even better, but they are very glam rock, pedal pushing little things in their gorgeous little capri latex, skinny tight jeans, and cork high plimsolls, but then with the huge, gorgeous head. But no, they were going to light up, the cerebellum and the chest cavity was going to light up when they used their stinger. And it's such a shame we never got to see their stinger. Partly A, because it caused too much heating up, and B, they found the effect to be unworkable.
So why was it unworkable?
Because the stinger looked like a penis.
Well, all they had to
stop them in cursing.
all they had to do was wrap it in a cloak. Because everyone knows that if you have a monster that looks like a penis, just wrap it in a cloak, and now it looks like a penis in a cloak.
Problem solved. In amongst all this exposition we get, of course, we get the Trilanic Activator, and while we're, pitching it fairly
high. Is that the thing that sucks under, that's like a champagne cork, that sucks onto your wrist and can crawl around the table like a Romy chess
piece? It does. And yes. So what they've been doing is somehow they've been attaching it to oil rigs where it emits... It emits a mating signal. And so the Scarisan comes along and humps the leg of the oil rig until it collapses.
And it chews it to death. I don't think I want to go on a date with the Scarisan.
Well, yeah, aquatic creatures have some very strange mating rituals. There is a type of octopus, for instance,
yes,
where the male tears off its penis and hurls it at the female, who inseminates herself.
I think we saw that in The State of Origin just last
week. I believe that was the cleanest, most scientific way I could put it. Poor bloody Scarisan, though. It's the only one on Earth, unless we take into account the one that Big Finish later puts in. And every time it thinks it's going for a date, it ends up with this anorexic oil rig.
Yeah.
It just gets covered in oil afterwards. It's not pleasant.
A date with an oleaginous Gwyneth Paltrow. It's never going to turn out well, is it?
I have a terrible soft spot for the Scarisan because just like those puppets in the late sort of Pertwee era, they all seem to be made out of sort of fox heads or terrier heads or something.
This one has real teeth, doesn't it?
It has real teeth and real sort of crazy rolling eyes, and it just looks like my dog Gracie.
Oh, who it does, too.
Had her podcasting debut on that Trust Your Doctor episode.
Yes,
so
yes.
It is like a little stop-motion Gracie.
It's a shaved Mr. Snuffleupagus, isn't it, really? Yeah. The way it walks as well.
Yeah, see, a lot of people kind of look at that and say, oh, no one makes fun of that. Why does everyone everyone make fun of the dinosaurs in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. And one, people do make fun of the Scarison and the stop motion. But I think the reason it doesn't come in for as much criticism is they learned from the mistake of the dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs were pretty poor puppets, whereas this is halfway decent stop motion.
It's actually very good stop motion. They just didn't have the time to do stop motion properly. It's a really nicely done effect.
You know, if you don't have Harryhausen, it's bloody good stop motion.
In episode 4, it is just a puppet, and they throw the last Trilanic activator into its mouth, and it chews really sort of dismally.
And you really do expect Tim Brooke Taylor to come down with Graham Gardner and Bill Oddie in a weather balloon, dressed as Squid.
Oh, now I want to see the Scarison versus Kitten King Kong. Rod and I have been making our way through the Godzillas again on Blu-ray, so yeah, there's a fight I want to see.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Atop the post office tower with Votan, Votan doing voiceovers.
In fact, that scene, and we're kind of leaping ahead to episode 4 here a bit, that scene where it appears in the World Energy Conference, it appears in front of a photograph of just the most dismal London office buildings by Thames Embankment, and it just looks like just every aspect of the scene looks so appallingly bad, and I just couldn't stop smiling. It was like the dinosaurs.
Hello, Sutek.
No, your story's not from...
it was like the dinosaurs in Invasion of the Dinosaurs. I just love that so much. I don't care that it's a terrible effect at all. Neither does Sutek.
No, that's right. And floating above the moor now, it sounds like someone's coming in their bobble.
I thought it was just the telly playing up again. Why have they got it held up from the ceiling like that? You can never adjust the horizontal hold.
Hi, guys. And so at the end of this story, we say goodbye to Harry. Was Harry Sullivan's potential fulfilled? Or was it the right time for the character to be written out? My space-time bubble seems to be passing through some sort of strange matter. Maybe antimatter. I guess I'll see you guys on the other side.
Evil Harry.
Evil Harry. Yeah, we get this wonderful...
Was Debbie Harry's birthday last week? She was 70.
Really?
She looks really good in this one, didn't she?
She did.
Ian Marta getting a chance to be evil. This is also Ian Marta's last story as a regular. And I think this story is the biggest one that proves we could have easily kept him on. I know he was brought in to be the muscle.
Yeah.
But because of his quality as an actor, he really rises above that. And we could have kept him.
And the rapport with Tom as well as with Liz, it's a perfect triumvirate. Mm. You're normally threesomes on screen don't tend to work out that well with it. It's why, again, the Avengers, you just have a man and a woman in most of those series. But the three-handed game is perfect. You know who was really pushing to keep him and wanted him to stay in the series? Douglas Camfield. And you know who kept insisting, not once, not twice, but exactly, three knocks. Three times he had the chance. Three times he said, no. And he's the first one to come now and say, I really wish we'd kept him on. Don't you love, right at the end, and sorry to jump forward, but it's much like what we do on this with this story as well. So yes, they've seen the monster off at World Ecology HQ, or, you know, BBC Television Centre beside the Thames. Isn't it the same point of focus that Janet Fielding finally says you can all bugger off at the end of Resurrection, Resuscitation,
Genuflection of the Daleks? It is a different location.
It just feels the same grey, miserable 70s temp. You forget how miserable 70s London was, but you watch Doctor Who, you've seen it. And then they all hot-footed up on the train, no less, because we know what a unit budget is, just to see the Doctor off. In Scotland. Okay, the Duke of Fogel's got to go home. Although somehow, where's he been all this time? But the Brigadier and Harry and Sarah all go up with the Doctor Scotland. just to see the Doctor off, because the TARDIS is up there. Yeah. At what point does Harry decide there's no way I'm ever going back again? Is it once he's got his old clobber on? So he I'm never going
his,
back.
Does he wear his... He
yeah, yeah, he's back outfit. In full dress.
And he's back in his full drag. And he says, no, Doctor, I'll be catching the train. And I just think that's such a shame. If the Brig... Because the Brig was offered as well. If the Brig and Harry had stuck around, they soon would have made mincemeat out of old Sutek, wouldn't they? It would have only been one episode long.
The Brigadier went and got other work, didn't he? He thought that he was pretty much over. Because remember, this is the last story of season 12,
yes,
really.
Yes, that's right.
So this is his second story of the year, if you like he's been doing the last couple
that's
of years.
Right. He's been doing that since sort of season 9, where unit stories top and tail the thing. I still think that it's strange that Sarah decides to get back in the TARDIS after the horrendous time that she's had in season 12.
It's not making a lot of sense.
But she clearly loves the Doctor, and that's it. You know, and he looks a bit forlorn when she says that she's not going to go with him, and so, you know, she decides to do that.
I also think this is a much better story for Sarah than the last three. She's a lot more proactive, she gets a lot more to do. She gets a few heroic moments as well.
I think it's just a bit less horrendous too. I think that the present-day Earth unit thing, I don't know whether Holmes is sort of pulling back. There's fewer Nazis in it, you know, there's less torture. You know, like, it's just generally a little bit more fun than what we've been having.
Yeah. The thing I really, really love about Sarah in this story, and I only noticed it the last time I watched it, when Evil Harry turns up and takes the Trilanic activator. Thank you. When Evil Harry turns up and takes the Trilanic activator, and Sarah goes after him, it's Sarah leading Sergeant Benton and the unit troops.
I love that scene. And they run after her.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that scene in the new series where Eccleston is facing down all the army blokes, and they hear a scream, and he's like, "Defense pattern tells her, move, move, move," and they all fall in behind. They all fall in behind Sarah, which is amazing, and it's shot so well by Canfield as well. Everyone's running towards the camera. It's comic book, it's dynamic, but it's also re-strengthening Sarah's character after she has been poorly treated the last few stories.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness that will never happen again for her. I actually think Harry's pretty sidelined here, apart from getting to be Evil Harry, because he is shot in episode one, and he really only rejoins them in episode four.
And, you know, I was thinking, that's never happened to a Doctor Who companion before, but it's happened in a Canfield story. It happened to Jamie. Jamie gets shot at the end of the invasion.
Oh, he has, like, a whole episode off, or two episodes, or the rest of the story off.
Well, he gets shot in episode seven, and, yeah, only gets shown in a film sequence of episode eight, because Fraser had a week off.
Yeah.
Canfield kind of likes killing or maiming the regular cast. I mean, look at Inferno.
I do think it is a little bit of a shame not to mention Sandifer again, given that he has the best way of understanding Broton and Broton's plan. So Broton's plan is to take over the world by disrupting the World Energy Conference.
Stanbridge House.
And he does that by just being a Bond villain.
Yeah.
He thinks that the way to take over the world is he's clearly been watching the Bond films on television during his time under the Loch. And he's decided that the best way of taking over the world is to be sort of terribly suave, to dress very nicely, to look superficially helpful and charming, but really to have, you know, a secret tunnel in your study that's operated by moving a book, and then to deviously arrange to blow up an entire building in London. So it's a crummy plan.
It is. You know what I mean? I'd like to think that, like Vivian Faye, and we don't see all the other portraits of the previous dukes, but I would like to think that it's actually just been Broton all these 700 years, which doesn't seem to count for much. Who else would have built that? You know, that again, the crummy revolving Young Frankenstein bookcase and the whole setup. No, it's just been him the whole time. Why else would he want to announce? He's so subtle and so careful and with how they secrete themselves, and yet he wants to look, it's a monster, and announce themselves to a world ecology get together. He really does, I think, move into his part a bit too much. He does believe that. I think he was actually going to ruin the world at all. I think Mike Yates would have been right up there with him, waving a tentacle from the balcony.
Yeah, I think, and I think possibly his favourite Bond film would be The Spy Who Loved Me, because there's lots of aquatic action in
lots
that.
And not Thunderball, because it's just silly. No,
not Thunderball.
Stromberg is a kind of terrible Bond villain.
Yeah,
well,
Stromberg is pretty bad. Yeah.
He won't even shake tentacles. Stromberg.
And, you know, come to think of it, around this time, being that this story is set in 1980 or 1981, so we've just had Moonraker and For Your Eyes Only is hot on its heels. Why could we be dropping all these Bond references? I don't know.
Can't imagine.
I can't begin to say how good this is, other than if you haven't seen it, please don't be led by this podcast. Just watch it. Don't, and if it's been terribly confusing, you won't be confused by watching it itself. It makes a lot more sense than we do.
And I'm sure Richard will heartily approve of this. This is one of the Target novels which has been recently reprinted by BBC Books. Unfortunately, they have modified the original cover. The original cover looks rather like a Looney Tunes cartoon with the Doctor's face in the middle of concentric, colourful circles.
Good old Chris Achilles with a huge Target. I have it right here somewhere too.
Yes. But yeah, do track it down if you can. Well, dear listeners, we could go on about this story for at least another 26 episodes, but that's all the time we have today for Terror of the Zygons. We will be back next week to discuss what is regarded as one of the classics of the Hinchcliffe era, if not Doctor Who overall.
No, we're doing Planet of Evil next week.
Oh, damn, I always get these story orders mixed up. I thought we were on Pyramids of Mars. No, it is Planet of Evil next week, and you know what that means. It means it's chest hair, and it's Paul Morrow, and it's, oh, God. Please, please just come back. Come back, everyone, for that.
It's got jungles.
It's got jungles.
It's got spangly jungles.
If nothing else, it's got jungles. So please do come back. Do check us out on Twitter at FTE Podcast, flightthroughentirety.com, and Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes. So you know what I'm going to mention at this point. Please review us on iTunes because I'm incredibly needy. But until then, thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night. I promise we'll get better if you review us. I promise.
That was Flight Through Entirety.
Actually, I haven't tested myself yet. How am I? I'm okay. All right.
Am I okay? Am I on?
You are not on.
Oh, that could have been bad.
Okay, go again.
And here we are. Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast where I don't get to say this thing.
Very radio, isn't it?
We shall release the Doctor No commentary on bondfinger.com. On August 1st.